Welcome to the Mobile Game Dev Playbook. This podcast is brought to you in association with Game Refinery. Join us as we uncover the latest trends in mobile game design.
Hello and welcome to the Mobile Game Dev Playbook. Thanks for tuning in for another episode. This is a podcast all about what makes a great mobile game. And today we are going to be diving deep into discussing player archetypes and motivations. What does that mean? It means how to better understand the features different types of players are interested in and how to ensure you design your game to attract and delight your target audience. I'm John Jordan, and joining me this week, as ever, is Joel Junkanen, co-founder and chief analyst at Game Refinery. How's it going, Joel?
Hi, John. It's great here in Finland. We are finally easing up the COVID restrictions and keeping our fingers crossed that maybe it doesn't get any worse.
Yes, yes. Slowly getting back to normal. Good. And our guests this week are Kieran O'Leary, who is Director of Growth for Games at Rovio and previously worked at Gameloft. How's it going, Kieran?
I'll go here. Very happy to get a chance to discuss about a deeply interesting topic that I think is going to be very entertaining and educative.
Good, good. And also with us is Oscar Clark, who's the Chief Strategy Officer at LiveOps Specialist Fundamentally Games and well-known industry hat wearer. Are you wearing a hat today, Oscar? We can't see
obviously.
You.
Obviously, I always wear a hat. Hats are essential.
Good. Now, how are you?
It's an interesting time because whilst everything's been going on around the world, we managed to close the seed round. So you can imagine how busy life gets when you're starting off essentially a new business.
Good, good. Excellent. So that's our setup for today. We're going to kick off. Joel, you're going to talk us a bit about the kind of ideas behind the motivations and archetypes feature, which is a new feature you've brought into the Game Refinery kind of toolkit so developers can kind of get to grips with these kind of features. So as I understand it, the idea behind the feature is really to allow designers to kind of think more about the type of audiences they're attracting. And you developed it by doing a lot of research. So you've interviewed a lot of kind of gamers and then tried to break down those kind of answers to come up with these archetypes. Is that broadly how it's happened?
Yeah, that's broadly how it's happened. So yeah, basically it all started because, of course, the industry is booming and all the developers and all the publishers are trying to find ways how to kind of find the edge against the competition. And of course, understanding the player motivations and why your players actually enjoy your game or why they churn out is really, really kind of interesting and important aspect of the whole design process. And of course, we at Game Refinery, we wanted to create a solution that would help all the developers, publishers to kind of get a kind of larger scale data about motivations to better understand what drives the engagement across different types of players. And yeah, like you said, all the data is based on huge amount of surveys. So basically what we did is we conducted a lot of surveys in English-speaking countries. So at the moment, it's only in the English-speaking countries and about 10,000 respondents. Then, of course, a lot of data science gets in the mix and out comes our motivational framework and also the player archetypes. So basically, at the moment, our model consists of 12 different motivation drivers. And then based on those motivation drivers, we've been able to create a set of 8 player archetypes, as we call them, like, for example, strategist or a networker. Those motivation drivers and then the player archetypes are part of our data set in the service. And now our users can use that data to, for example, better understand their own players and own games and how their features in their games resonate with the different player archetypes and motivations. But also, and I think even more importantly, because it's a scalable solution, they can understand their competition, different genres, different groups of games. So it's not only about manual research about one or two games and their audiences, but about actually hundreds of thousands of titles.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting because I guess from every interview you do, you kind of every individual is an individual, obviously. But when you draw together a lot of this data, and that's obviously what big data does across the whole, all of technology, is then you try and work out what things are kind of broadly the same across different kind of groups, and then I guess you're trying to reduce it down to as many groups as makes it kind of manageable for designers, but equally enough kind of flavor across those different groups. So you've got these eight archetypes. Why did you think eight was a good number?
Yeah, so the eight archetypes are based on actually the data research. So how we ended up with the eight types was basically we started to once we had those 12 different motivations mapped out based on the surveys, we started to see with the different kind of statistical modeling that different motivations were combined in different answers to high degree. And then, of course, we found that there are statistically meaningful group of eight different kind of clusters. There were a couple of other clusters. So there could be, we could have had 10 archetypes, but those two weren't as statistically significant. So we kind of, at the moment, we have eight of those archetypes because we feel and the data suggests that it is able to cover the different archetypes pretty well without kind of becoming too clustered or too vague. So that's basically it. And of course, I want to highlight here that because I can understand that when somebody hears about player archetype, like for example, strategist, and thinks about which of these am I. But of course, the truth is that all of us, basically, depending on the time and the date and the mood, we might have a lot of characteristics from several different archetypes. Myself, for example, I see myself more as kind of a strategist / king of the field because I like to compete in tactical and strategy games. And so basically, it's not just black and white.
No, it's not either or thing. And I guess, you know, when it comes down to using it, what it's useful for is allowing kind of designers to have a bit more insight into the kind of the type of kind of player kind of motivation, and then look at competing games and see how they're kind of dealing with that. And it just provides, I guess, a better feeling than just looking at maybe kind of broader research numbers. It just kind of gives a bit of a humanizing look to it. And I guess one example here I was looking at, and it says, an example like Fortnite kind of caters to the thrill seekers, skill masters, and king of the hills, but not so much to people who are motivated by thinking. So you can, I guess from that, you can kind of see the broad way in which these kind of archetypes can be used. So they're not like, yeah, as you say, they're not black and white, and it's not a right or wrong thing. It just provides people who are designing games or making new features for games, you know, better insight into what's going on.
Yeah, exactly. And I just wanted to add that it's interesting when you start to kind of research different types of games. We, in this podcast, we've been discussing about genre mashups and different kinds of games. It's interesting to see that if you take different genres and kind of genre games, you can see that they might share similar motivation driver sets, basically. And that might be interesting when you're thinking about what genres would, for example, work well as a kind of a mashup. If you think about, you mentioned Fortnite and kind of different motivation drivers that Fortnite caters to, you can find similar kind of motivation clusters from games from different genres as well, even from the casual genre, for example. And then, or casino, like poker games, there's a lot of competition and kind of king of the hill stuff going on, but from a bit different angle. So that might also act as kind of an inspiration for many of the designers to start understanding that players who play Fortnite might actually enjoy different genre games as well that cater to the similar kind of motivation drivers.
Mm-hmm. Good. So, Kieran and Oscar, what are your thoughts about player archetypes? I guess it's something that's been around in games for quite a long time now. Is that something that's useful for you to get your heads around?
Yeah, and it's been around for as long as I've been around in terms of games. I remember talking to Richard Bartle years ago about what he did with MUD and the classic model that most of us first introduced in terms of using personas in games. So back in the idea of, you know, when Richard was doing MUD, you know, when he looked at things like, you know, the killers, achievers, socializers, and explorers, what was interesting about what he was doing there, and similar to what Game Refinery is now doing at a much deeper level, was that he was looking at the consequences of not just the personality types, but the player types, but what it meant in terms of game design. In fact, even my traditional marketing training looks at this model in quite a lot of detail, like personas. We were always thinking about what are the personas that we're trying to design against. So it's invaluable to have something where you've got at least some kind of firm foundation in data that you can use to create inspiration, so that you're not just trying to make a game for yourself, you're trying to make a game for an audience. So I think it's very difficult to do that without having something to grab onto that's got some data foundation.
Yeah, I agree with that. That's a topic that's been around for a long time. But I think the main evolution in regards to that topic is, first of all, that it's much more accessible to a larger group of people. And I think that one of the beauty behind what Game Refinery is doing is making that information accessible to as many people as there are people who are interested in that topic. So that's one thing. And I think the focus is also shifting from simply game design to the way we advertise these very games. And now I think a lot of that thinking is embedded within the creative design itself. So you want to make sure that, of course, your players are satisfied with the game experience that you're delivering. But in the first place, you also need to make sure that you communicate in the right way with the audience that you're trying to attract to your games. So in that sense, the creative messaging and the very design should also be aligned with these motivations and player archetypes.
That's a very good point, because it is, as you say, kind of goes beyond the kind of pure design kind of aspect of a game. And now mobile games are so much around games as a service. So you're obviously coming up with what you feel is a kind of great, unique kind of concept that's going to appeal to a lot of people. But then having these kind of archetypes, and that also then feeds through into other bits of a company, like say Rovio, so the marketing department know who we're making this game for, and you can kind of, well, you know, this kind of sets it out. Obviously, you could have that before these archetypes, but I think they probably help kind of almost like internal kind of knowledge.
It's a shorthand as well, isn't it? Mm. It's an easier way to communicate in a meaningful way that you know will be understood on the other side, and having this kind of, you know, this idea that you're marketing led, you're kind of your audience led. And that you can have a common understanding of what you mean by that, that's invaluable. I mean, it doesn't really particularly matter which one you do, but I quite like the fact that, you know, with something like Game Refinery, I'm able to look at kind of a gamer score, you know, power score for the game. I'm able to look at the data for similar games. I'm able to look at the personas and how they apply. I think that provides us with a bit more vision about where we're going when we're trying to address what we want to achieve with a particular game.
That's very true. That last point, it also creates alignment between the teams. Like, there is something very interesting that we do sometimes internally, which is to gather the core team in a room and we ask them which motivations they think their design is catering for. And once you've got that settled, then everything becomes easier, because first of all, you've got a roadmap that's clear, and you can also communicate much more easily with other stakeholders in regards to what you're trying to achieve. So that includes obviously marketing. But even within the team, it's sometimes interesting to see that not everybody has the same audience in mind. So as soon as you start using archetypes, that the communications start being much more easy.
Yeah, I mean, a classic example of that is, you know, if you say to someone, all right, okay, so I'm targeting this at a 51-year-old guy who works in IT. What that means to some people is going to be very different to others. So if you take me as an example, I work in games. I'm far from being the typical 51-year-old working in IT. And if I was trying to think about a game for me, it would be very different from me trying to come up with a game for somebody who fit that criteria.
Mm. I remember it wasn't a mobile games company, but I remember that there have been games companies in the past. They've actually, you know, kind of created kind of mock individuals of who they thought they, you know, when they're working on a game, actually kind of, you know, getting photos of them and saying this is who they are, sort of thing, to try and kind of get teams to kind of think about what those people wanted. And I guess this is an extension of that, and puts numbers around it in a much more formalized way. So
that's exactly what personas is all about. We're going to name these people. We want to know, have they got kids? What are their kids? You know, and it's most of the time it's a hypothesis. It's a thought experiment where we're trying to create a kind of real story, a narrative around those individuals. But it's a difficult thing, because if you're just doing it as a thought experiment, you can miss a number of things. So the more data we can bring into that, the more solid that thought experiment can be. And what's interesting is when you evolve those personas over time, and so you're looking for actually what is our analysis saying is the typical group of people who look like this. And so we want this combination between real, you know, concrete data and also narrative story that we can emotionally engage with, so we can think clearly about what that player is about. Mm.
And I guess something that's mentioned, if people are interested in kind of the background to this research, is a guy called Richard Bartle. And if you look on Wikipedia at the Bartle taxonomy of player types, there's quite a good page on that. I mean, there's quite a lot of stuff and videos of Richard talking about that. But basically, he was formed in the in the kind of early 2000s, I think, or even before that. And he had,
slightly earlier than that. It was part of March.
1969, yeah.
Yeah. It's also worth looking at some of Richard's work. He did talking about why his bottle type shouldn't be used for every game. He's really, a really smart guy. And he did a series of talks about why that applied to months and why we should be thinking about different taxonomies for other types of game. And I think, like I say, the Game of Runny guys are one of many groups who are trying to do that.
So, yes, and I guess, just very briefly, his kind of four types were killers, achievers, socializers, and explorers, which I guess are very, very broad. But I guess people kind of more easily fall into those kind of categories. But when we're doing something very specific around mobile games, which is, say, very different from multi-user dungeons, the old MUDs, mainly text-based, we've moved on somewhat since then. But kind of broadly, when we're thinking about kind of the games we kind of like individually, do we think we fit into a set of kind of archetypes? Maybe not one, but do you feel the sorts of games that you like are, that's kind of backed up by the kind of motivations you like to do in games? Kieran, what do you think?
I think I'm very much of a skill master. I like getting that sensation that I'm actually mastering what I do, like at every concrete level, and feeling the progression that comes with it. So I have a natural inclination for, say, like first-person shooters, because there is so much that I can improve myself by, just playing the game. I don't really like anything that has to do with a chance. So the more I feel like I'm actually mastering my skills, the better I feel.
What about you, Oscar?
So it depends. That sounds a terrible cop-out, but now I have different... There's two ways of looking at persona types when you take them on. I can have a mood and a mode. So I have my default behavior, but it is affected by the mode of use. So that's affected by the device I'm using. In particular, there are other reasons why mode of use can be different. And my behavior, when I'm, say, for example, using a mobile game, is very different from my behavior when I'm playing a console game. So if I'm playing a console game, I'm typically going to be kind of the thinker type. I might be playing a strategy game, for example, but the way I behave in that, I'm not particularly worried about socialization. I'm thinking more about the processes and optimization, if that makes sense. Whereas if I'm playing a mobile game, I'm going to be much more distracted. I'm going to be doing something which is about occupying a moment. And yet when I play a PC game, because of the setup process that goes on, I will often be much more competitive. I'm much more social, much more engaged. So it really depends on a number of factors and a mode of use, so the type of device I'm using, the moment of opportunity, so the mood I'm in, are big factors on the type of personality that I'll be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I kind of did it the other way, but by taking the archetypes and then kind of crossing out the ones I wasn't. So I'm not very competitive, I'm not very social. So I'm kind of left with kind of a treasure hunting, I suppose.
Nothing wrong with that. There's moments like Skyrim, for me, is the classic one, where I love Skyrim, and there are points where I'm basically killing dragons, but there are other points where I'm still... I have fond memories, which is the same principle. There's lots of games like this that have the same principle. But it's the games which have the moments where you can walk through the fields and pick flowers that I love the most. It's odd. I don't know why that appeals to me so much.
Joel, how do you... I guess... You should have thought about this because you've been working on it for so long. where do you sit in the pack in this kind of pecking order?
Actually, I think I kind of have a similar mindset with Oscar, that it kind of depends if it's a PC or console or mobile. But overall, I would say, as I said before, that I'm definitely strategist, and then I would say king of the hill, kind of, because I always love those strategy games, Civilizations, all of them, Master of Orion's back in the day. And then I never actually thought of myself as kind of competitive player. But then after starting my Hearthstone career, kind of, it's getting worse and worse. So I kind of love those PvPs and beating the opponent. So I would say maybe a combination of those two.
I guess it's a good point. You get competitive if you are actually good at something. I'm not competitive because I'm rubbish at games.
Yeah.
But if I found a game I was good at, maybe I would get more competitive.
But it's also interesting to note that as we get older, then the motivation set also changes. Some studies have clearly showed that as you get older, then competition become less of a motivation. I don't know if that's because we can afford the time to grind so much games to remain competitive, or that's based on something else, but that's something that's true as well.
Joel, do you think that these archetypes can be used in a way to kind of find or to kind of inspire kind of designers to kind of come up with new concepts? And I guess more broadly, there's been an ongoing, not really debate, but I guess an ongoing kind of idea that there are certain kind of underserved groups even in mobile games where we think we've got, like, you know, 2 million people play mobile games, but there's an idea that certainly a few years ago we kind of thought that maybe kind of women were an underserved kind of audience. Do we think these archetypes can maybe finesse those sort of opportunities?
Yes, most definitely. I think a good example is the match tree evolution. Before, if you think about Candy Crush and those other kind of first generation casual match tree games, and then how Playrix basically started this narrative decoration meta-layer match trees with Gardenscapes, Homescapes, and Fishdom. I think that's a good example, thinking about that. When they introduced that meta layer or narrative or decorative aspects, they kind of tapped into the new area that, if you think about our archetypes, for example, they started to cater to expressionists. And by understanding the players who already played those match three games, they probably noticed that by introducing these aspects to the game, they were able to broaden the kind of the target groups or the people who would like to play their game. And also, because many of the players who played Masteries, casual Masteries, already had these tendencies to like decorative stuff or narrative stuff, it kind of reinforced their motivations even further. So that's a good example how you can use these motivations and archetypes to, when you start thinking about what new should we bring to our game, and then, of course, thinking about your current gamer base to not kind of alienate those, but also think if there's new segments of players who are already kind of have some overlap with your current game in terms of motivations, and then starting to introduce new features that would kind of bring them all over in a kind of a larger quantities without, of course, as said, alienating your current gamer base. So most definitely that can be used.
Because I guess we often think of the kind of creative process as being coming up with a new game, but if mobile games have proved anything over the last kind of 5-6 years, it's the continuation, it's the kind of the you know, the operation of a game, which you kind of always have to bring new things in. I mean, I guess for certain types of games you want to bring in kind of new characters every kind of so often to keep that kind of interesting, and on the competitive kind of side, give new metas and things, but equally you want to add new sorts of features that people haven't experienced before, because that keeps, you know, on a wider level, that keeps the whole game kind of more exciting, because it's going in directions hopefully that the audience wants. I mean, Oscar, as a, you know, looking for your kind of coming from a live ops operation, I mean, obviously you're kind of starting out on that, but do you think this is, how useful will this be in terms of kind of expanding audiences in that way?
Well, I think it's kind of critical, because the whole point about live ops for me is about finding more people, getting them to do more things more often for longer. Well, you don't help people find things they care about unless you understand them. And so you've got to understand that what's motivating them in the current content. You've got to understand what's motivating them in what content that might or might not be needed to be made, but also how you can kind of optimize particular experiences around events and promotions and various activities around this community that means something. If you don't ask people, if you don't pay attention, if you don't actually have something to base it on, based on data, you can't really be effective in defining things. So I think they're a fantastic way to start, and I think they're a great way to use as a form for inspiration. And I think with all these things, it's about creating hypotheses. So I think personas are vital for creating these hypotheses you can build on. And then you use real data based on the responses from that, based on the specific targets, you know, specific players you've got. Because at the end of the day, it's about making games people care about and want to invest more time and money into.
Good. Kieran, do you want to talk a bit about what's going on with at Rovio? I think you've got some a new game coming out, and do you want to tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, well, we have this game, Small Town Mirrors, which has been in soft launch for a few months now. So that's a match three game with a very innovative take on the narration. So no decoration whatsoever. It's really about solving cases. So the entire game experience is driven by you as a detective trying to solve new cases and figure out who murdered a few people within a very nice village. So going back to what we said previously, I think that there is escapism that's also a big driver for a lot of casual puzzle game players. that we didn't feel was catered to by other games. So that's the direction that we decided to investigate by adding this like narrative-driven meta progression within the game.
So would that, would we see this with small town murders? Would that be like a classic kind of mashup? Was that the kind of the vibe you were thinking about? You know, I guess match three is the most obvious kind of mechanic that people like to use for mashups because it appeals so widely and broadly. Everyone kind of knows what to do with the match three. So was it a case of like, we got match three, what can we add on to it? Or
That's not a proper mashup. Like when I think mashup, I think about like games such as puzzle RPGs. In our case, I'd say that the approach in regards to narration is entirely new. It's not something that I've seen anywhere else. So obviously, I'm preaching for my core here, but I truly think it's something that's entirely new within the market.
We're gonna have to come up with another a better term than mashup for things that are bigger than a mashup. Anyone got any ideas? What can we? I don't know. Hybridization. That sounds a bit.
Yeah, that sounds a little bit barbaric, but let's say that we're amplifying the narrative experience, and that's it truly gives a purpose to the player.
Mm. And for something like Rovio, obviously you've released lots of games now, but still known as the kind of the Angry Birds studio. How do you look at your existing audience and go that we've got to kind of play to within that audience, or do you feel now it's so long ago you've got like a, you know, you can do whatever you want with it?
That's a very good question. So there is something that we believe very strongly in, which is genre mastery, which is saying that I don't think there is a chance to improvise yourself as a new, say, I don't know, like a racing game publisher. So each and every studio that we have within the company is focusing on a very specific game genre, which is also saying that they need to master the audience that we're designing games for. So in that sense, we're very much focused. And I think that it's a key component of success within these markets. So, for example, if I like being very concrete, we have the Casual Puzzle Studio, which is making games such as Angry Birds, Dream Blast, Sugar Blast, or Small Town Murders. We've got the RPG Studio over in Stockholm. We have the Battle Studio. So, to answer your question, there is a very defined scope for each and every studio that we have. And I think it fits very nicely what we've been saying during this entire conversation, which is that you need to start from the audience and make sure that you absolutely nail what motivates them to play and who they are.
Yeah. And Oscar, that's changed quite a lot from obviously when we started off with mobile games and people would like move around genre to genre. They'd have a go at match three and then they'd have a go, maybe not quite a shooter, but an RPG or something like that. Do you think we've lost some of that? I don't know what the term is, kind of amateur enthusiasm for just trying to come up with something? Because I guess those kind of things, you have a lot of failures, which now gets very expensive, but there is some sort of kind of creativity that potentially the industry has kind of maybe not lost but kind of put in a box by saying, well, you're a match three studio, start with match three and kind of move on from there.
I'm not so sure about that. I mean, I think yes, there are cases where that has happened and there are really good reasons to do that, particularly because essentially, you know, you're likely to fail with your first game and you've got to learn about how to fix the issues and learn how to improve and compete. And they, you know, with such a kind of level of mastery of game design in those areas, of course, you know, you're going to get specialists who are going to do that. And that's great. But I don't think there's any lack of innovation. I mean, for all of its downsides, the hyper-casual market has proven that there is demand for people to innovate rapidly. And yes, there are constraints about how that innovation works. But when you look at, you know, people turning idle games into hyper-casual experiences, to me, that's really interesting. What I find most fascinating about that, and it's easy to underestimate the power of it, it's the ability to simplify. I've relished that, but mostly because I'm not very good at that bit. I like to overcomplicate things. But anyone who can take an original idea and completely break it down to its smallest possible proportions and make something that's still fun, they, you know, I'll take my hat off to them. That is real creativity. Now, there are other ways that gets used. Actually, innovating and disrupting in an existing genre is similarly just as innovative. It's harder to do, though, because in order to be disruptive and creative, you've got to be able to know entirely why a game works. And I mean, you know, really understand, you know, if you're doing match three and you're going to do something brand new with it, you need to understand what it is you're actually doing and why the players will care. So again, we've got to understand the audience. Again, we've got to understand the personas behind it all. So I think there is more than enough space for innovation, more than enough space for ideas. We don't have that magical kind of like, we haven't done this before on a mobile device, because pretty much we have. And there is something sort of really amazing about when you do get that balance of having extraordinary creative experiences applied to just one small fragment of a game. And I think it's why we're seeing games like, with, you know, Robbie was talking about, where you're bringing together different genres and smashing them together to make hybrid ideas. That idea of taking three aspects of one game and three aspects of another one and making a brand new experience, brilliant. That's all valid creativity. At the end of the day, game designers' job is to essentially solve problems. It's too easy to sort of assume that it means they've got to come up with a brand new genre. That's not where real creativity comes. It's when you fix a problem that no one else has managed to solve. That's when it's really creative.
Hmm. I guess it's a good point about hyper-casual. I mean, Joel, we've spoken about hyper-casual, you know, quite a lot in previous episodes. And, you know, I guess the excitement of hyper-casual have been these, as the term has risen there, they're kind in the nicest possible way, they're kind of throwaway experiences. They're just meant to be kind of enjoyed and creative. And if people don't understand them or people don't like them, then there's always another one to come along. And I guess that's been the most recent wave of that kind of early kind of stage of creativity we had in mobile games. And it's kind of every few years it comes up again in another format.
There's always a new cycle of the new. And I think that's what's really interesting. What's also interesting, though, is we often see the same patterns of behavior with each new platform. So the kind of, everyone seems to want to do a pool game at the start of every new platform or every new kind of implementation. I don't know what it is about pool games. I like pool games, but it seems to be one of the first things that people try to do. Bubble pop games are also one of the first things people try to do. You know, the match threes are always something people want to do very early on. So it's interesting, although there's lots of creativity in early stages of platforms, often it's the same early stage creativity. People trying to replicate an experience they had on a previous platform quite often.
Absolutely. Everything's in a big cycle. Cool. Well, I think that is it for today. I think we've well and truly gone through archetypes and seen the value of those. So everyone, you can head over to Game Refinery and have a look at what they've been doing. But just left for me to say a big thank you to our guests. Thank you, Joel.
Thank you, John. And thank you to our guests as well.
And thanks, Kieran.
Thank you, everyone.
I guess we'll be checking out, Small Town Murders is out very soon, so we'll be looking out for that in your App Store. And thanks for Oscar and his hat.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me, and good talking to you all.
Good. And if you've enjoyed this podcast, and of course you have, please do subscribe to the Mobile Game Dev Playbook on your podcast platform of choice. We're available on them all. And why not give us a review? That helps other people find out about us too. But thanks for listening, and we hope you join us again soon.